We'll go on to the next case. Our second case of the day is Appeal 064008, Christiana Attanisi versus Peter Keisler. Good morning, Ms. Stotland.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Hannah Stotland. I represent the petitioner, Christiana Attanisi. The case comes before the court on petition for review of two decisions of the Board of Immigration Appeals, or BIA. The petitioner seeks remand to the BIA so that the agency may consider Ms. Attanisi for a discretionary waiver of inadmissibility. At the heart of this case is an immigration judge who failed to follow regulations and two one-person BIA panels that failed to correct the IJ's errors of law. The agency disregarded its own rules and precedents in refusing to consider Ms. Attanisi for discretionary relief. Remand is necessary so that the agency can fulfill its regulatory obligations.
Could I just ask you something about the 28J letter?
Yes.
Let me make sure that I understand your response to that Oyeyo decision that the Attorney General cited. Your position is that because Mrs. Attanisi has not yet been admitted to the U.S., she is still eligible for a Section 212D3 waiver and does not need the sort of retroactive waiver that FIAO says an immigration judge is without the authority to give. Is that your position?
That's correct, Your Honor. Our first response to In Matter of Fuello is a Chenery response. In other words, this entire line of argument is impermissible. The BIA and IJ did not reach the question of whether Ms. Attanisi was eligible under 212D3. Therefore, the government attorney may not defend the agency's actions on grounds never expressed or, in this case, even hinted at by the agency.
But, you know, there's a logical issue here that we need to get to the bottom of, because if the IJ thought that as he's looking at Ms. Attanisi in the hearing, she's not eligible for the 212D3 waiver because she never asked in Nigeria, I don't see where the duty to inform her that there might be such a thing comes from, because surely IJs don't have to give a big, long lecture about all of the things that are not available. And it does seem to me, looking at the language of the relevant regulation for that kind of waiver, which seems to refer to presenting it at the consular office considering the visa application, that the IJ may well have thought that. So where does this prior duty even come from?
The prior duty comes from 8 CFR, section 1240.11, and referring to that regulation, under paragraph A2 of that section, if the alien is in, this is referring to an alien before an IJ, physically present in the country but not admitted.
Right.
If the alien is inadmissible under any provision of Section 212A of the Act, which refers to the type of inadmissibility that covers Ms. Attanisi, and believes that he or she meets the eligibility requirements for a waiver of the ground of admissibility, he or she may apply to the immigration judge for such waiver. Therefore, the alien has multiple opportunities to present such an application for a waiver.
Well, but that's a legal issue here. I mean, some waivers, as even the board is willing to say, the 212I, for example, could be asked for at that stage of the game, but it looks to me like 212D3 is a more limited waiver that you've got to ask up front when you're at the consular office still, you know, often Nigeria in this case, for that waiver, and that you can't just come in and say once you're before the IJ, oh, by the way, I'd like a 212D3 waiver.
Well, we did cite to two opinions of the Board of Immigration Appeals itself. They are published precedential en banc opinions in Kazemi and LaFlock. And in both of those cases, an alien was in Ms. Atunisa's position, physically present in the U.S. and before an IJ, but had not appealed for 212D, applied for 212D relief before physically arriving in the country. They had not applied at the consulate. But in both of those cases, the BIA recognized the right of aliens to apply under those circumstances.
Your view is that the regulation is not talking about aliens who have been lawfully admitted for permanent residence. Rather, it's talking about aliens who are seeking the creation of the status of an alien lawfully admitted for permanent residence, which would seem to include Mrs. Atunisi.
That's correct.
And it's your view that the regulation makes it pretty crystal clear, I guess, that the regulation includes aliens like her, so that the regulatory duty to apprise an alien of her right to seek a waiver of inadmissibility applies to her. Ergo, because the IJ never advised her of her right to seek relief under Section 212D3, can't be said to have waived her right to seek that relief. Is that it?
Yes, that is it. And that result is compelled by this court's decision in Asani v. INS, where although a different type of relief was sought, the same obligation of the IJ was violated and excused the purported waiver on the part of the alien. I also think that it's critical that in the section that I cited there, 8 CFR 1240.11A2, going to the duties of the IJ, it says alien. It does not say immigrant. Therefore, it covers those aliens who have not yet acquired the status which Ms. Atunis seeks.
How do we factor in the fact that she never sought relief from a consular officer first? Or do we not factor it in? Or does it matter in any way?
I don't believe that it does matter in any way. Ultimately, that is one. She was certainly eligible to file to request that waiver at the consulate in Nigeria. But I think it's important to realize that these foreign consulates do not, in fact, have the power to grant the waiver. All the consulate does is establish that the alien is admissible but for the grounds for which waiver is sought. That's undisputed here.
But isn't that important? Because if you look at 8 CFR 212.7A1, little one, it doesn't say one option for an applicant who wants a waiver is to seek it at the consular office. It says an applicant for an immigrant visa or K non-immigrant visa who's inadmissible and seeks a waiver shall file an application on Form I-601 at the consular office. And so I'm having trouble with that, trying to see how it is that it's more than, you know, well, how it is that is not the first step you have to take. And then if you're unsuccessful there, perhaps you can renew it before an IJ. Perhaps you can go forward with it. But shall file this application at the consular office seems pretty clear.
Well, again, reading that regulation together with 8 CFR 1240.11, the BIA itself in LaFlock, which decision was embraced more recently in Kazemi, that reading those regulatory portions together results in what is in essence two different options for manners of applying. And in particular, I'd also like to point out that there is a catch-all regulation in the regulation 8 CFR 1240.1 describing the authority of immigration judges. There is a catch-all provision at A little 4 saying that the IJ has an opportunity, or rather the power, to take any other action consistent with applicable law and regulations as may be appropriate. Reading that together with, again, the BIA's decisions in Kazemi and LaFlock strongly suggests that in practice the agency reads Ms. Atunis's style of application as permissible.
Now, if we were, I take from the way you're arguing this that you recognize that D3 is actually a better fit for the K3 visa than 212I.
Well, we recognize certainly that the language is more clear.
Right. And you know, since we are only judges, you know, and we have to follow statutory language when it says K3 visas are non-immigrant visas, even though, as you've rightly pointed out, there are lots of things that make them quite similar to immigrant mm-hmm. visas, but there are lots of different consequences to having an immigrant visa versus a non-immigrant visa. And the statute, at least, calls these non-immigrant visas. It's a little, you're asking a lot of us to say, well, we're going to recharacterize as an immigrant visa anyway to go over to I.
Well, I don't believe that the visa need be characterized as a non-immigrant visa in order, as an immigrant visa in order to come under 212I, rather that relief available to immigrants may be available. I see that I'm running out of time, so.
That's your rebuttal time. You can save it or use it as you wish.
I prefer to save it. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Mattson.
Good morning.
Back again.
Let me kind of bring us back a little bit on the nature of the proceedings here. This is an admissibility hearing. An admissibility hearing is different. The judge's decision was part of an admissibility hearing. Ms. Atunis certainly seeks to enter. In an admissibility hearing, the burden of proof is on the arriving alien to establish that they are clearly and beyond doubt entitled to enter the United States. In addition, the INA also places the burden on the alien applying for relief to establish satisfaction of the eligibility requirements and for discretionary grants of relief that the alien merits a favorable discretionary decision. Ms. Atunis has failed to establish any of those. And the two charges that were presented have not been challenged. She's been charged with a fraud in the obtaining of a visa and with having an invalid entry document. Each is contained in Section 212. The fraud charge is 212A6, and the invalid document is at A7.
But you agree, don't you, that had she, back in Nigeria, asked for a D3 waiver, she could have been considered for that?
There's more to consular scrutiny than has been addressed yet. I had intended to get to that, but...
But suppose she had answered this question on the form, yes. You know, this is a terrible form, by the way, but I don't know why the government was economizing on bullet points, but anyway, suppose she had answered this question, yes, because part of it says, have you ever been refused admission to the U.S.? Goes on, and so the answer to that, of course, is yes, we all now know. And she then filed the form I-601 in Nigeria, and said, I'd like a waiver. I've done everything right since then. I've stayed here for 5 years. You know, I haven't tried to reenter, blah, blah, blah. She could have been considered, right? I'm not saying it would have been granted or not, but she was eligible.
The consular scrutiny, and in fact, no, she's not eligible. The consular scrutiny requires the presentation of evidence that she has not applied for a visa or returned to the United States during the five-year bar period.
Well, they probably would have told her that. Then, I mean, as she filled out the I-601, maybe they would have said, we need more information before we can process this, but the record doesn't indicate that she did try to go back to the United States during that period, does it?
It does at page 215 of the administrative record. In her interview with the Customs and Border Protection officer, she said that she applied for a visa on February 18th of 2000. And did not disclose that, and it was not addressed at any other time during the proceedings.
But nothing came of it.
Nothing came of it because there was never a waiver that or a consular scrutiny that would have.
So you're going to punish people for just putting a piece of paper in that they then abide by when they don't get it?
The requirement for consular scrutiny of visas is essential in the process. It is the first line of review in the application for a visa.
Where does it say that it's unlawful to apply?
It's not unlawful to apply. It's unlawful to apply within the five-year period, and that's in the State Department regulations. Once you're found to have fraudulently attempted to enter the country, you're barred for 5 years from either applying or from entering the United States. At the end of the five-year period, as counsel for Ms. Attenese argued before the immigration judge, she would have been eligible. Well, presuming that she would have been eligible presupposes the consular scrutiny required for the issuance of a visa. It reaches the conclusion that the consular officer never had the opportunity to deal with or develop a record or to provide a recommendation to the State Department, who would then forward that recommendation on to the Department of Homeland Security, the district director.
But isn't all of that true? Maybe I'm way off base, but isn't all of that true? Because she abandoned that.
She abandoned. I'm not.
Well,
sure.
She didn't go forward with that 2000.
I have no other information in this record as to that, other than her statement to the CBP officer. I applied for a visa in 2000. There was no other inquiry and no other development of that throughout the hearing. I don't know what happened to that.
So is that mooted out?
It may have become important in the review of a 212D3 waiver properly filed.
But that's so speculative. I really think we can't make too much of that. What about these cases? I mean, your opponent is reading the D3 requirements in a sense to permit, before the alien is admitted, consideration beyond the consular office, even if the person doesn't ask at the consular office. She theoretically, even though she's sitting around the McHenry County Jail, isn't in the country, right? So she's not admitted.
She's not. All
right.
Of the regulations specifically say in 212D3 waivers, you must apply from overseas. The only situation addressed in the two cases noted, and returning to those two cases, particularly the Kazemi decision, where an alien renews his Section 212D4 waiver, which is a separate waiver that I may return to in a few moments, renews that D4 waiver in exclusion proceedings following an initial denial by the district director. It's the district director that gets the first cut on that kind of thing, because the district director in this particular case in New York has the opportunity to go back to his records and say, well, why was she removed? When did it happen? Who did it? What were the facts of the case? It develops the record for the purpose of board review. And then, as in the Kazemi decision, well, there's another application. Let's return it now to the immigration judge and let him deal with all of it, because otherwise we have to split the case.
Assuming that the IJ did have the authority to consider a request for relief under 212D3, then why wasn't the immigration judge obliged to advise her of her right to seek relief under that provision? I mean, you've got an immigration judge here who asked her name asked her to raise her right hand, asked her if her lawyer was her lawyer. And that's the end of it. I mean, that's the end of his intercourse with her.
There was no development in this case because she failed to present any evidence to indicate that she was entitled to enter the country. The judge attempted to address the admissibility issue first on several occasions. There was the asylum application that
was... Well, I mean, other than the fact that she has a husband, a 5-year-old daughter, you know, that she's an illiterate, that she stayed back in Nigeria for 5 years, you know, in order to try...
The immigration judge gave every opportunity, several continuances, and then said, by May 17th, you must file applications for relief. I believe that the immigration judge did everything that he could to encourage Ms. Atunis to pursue any kind of evidence, and it was her burden to present evidence that showed that she was entitled to enter the country and that she was entitled, eligible for discretionary relief.
What could she have done that was not done here?
Tell the truth. At her consular meeting.
All she had to do was leave. But you've already said that wouldn't have done any good.
Yes.
And
so there's nothing, basically.
The unfortunate aspect of this case is not only that there's nothing that she can do, but that she still has remaining, even if we assume that the 212I waiver is granted, she still has an A7 charge for which there has been no, there are two waivers offered for those. But they have not even been proposed, certainly not applied for, and she is required to apply for those.
Where?
The A7 charge is broken down into two categories, immigrant and non-immigrant. Immigrants may seek a waiver under 212K.
Well, but that's not her.
It's not applicable. The non-immigrant waiver is at 212D4, and it is a significant waiver. It requires jointly a statement by the Department of State and the Attorney General, because this implicates consular scrutiny, because this implicates a visa issued by the Department of State.
Okay, now how could she have gotten that? What I'm trying to figure out is, when I look at this, it's gotcha, it's gotcha, it's gotcha. How?
She must apply for a waiver at the consulate on a separate form for the D4 waiver. It's I-601, but it has to identify the previous removal.
Back in Nigeria.
That's correct.
She has to go back to Nigeria. Yes. She has to wait another now 10 years, I take it. And answer that 5-part question that dare say some of us couldn't figure out.
It actually doesn't even use up-to-date terminology. It refers to deportation hearings, which haven't existed for some years now, a decade.
And some of the regulations have not caught up with changes in the statute.
So if somebody honestly answered, no, I haven't had a deportation hearing, it was a removal hearing, that's just too bad because the department hasn't bothered to bring its form up to date?
I struggle to get my mind around the idea that someone could go through an expedited removal hearing and not remember or not understand the question. This individual applied with 4 different names on 3 separate occasions to enter the United States. Honest people don't do that.
Desperate people do.
Desperate people may, but it is unfortunate, but the nature of the Immigration and Nationality Act establishes control over the borders in the political branches of government, and the right to exclude remains. And the right to have consular scrutiny of visas is essential. It is the first step in reviewing those who attempt to come to our country. The State Department must have an opportunity, and then the Department of Homeland Security. The reconstruction of the Customs Service and now aligning duties with State Department, Department of Homeland Security and the Attorney General is, as a person involved, confusing to me, deciding who it is that's dealing with which. And in this particular case, there may be 2 separate agencies involved in the Department of Homeland Security.
It is a miracle to me that anyone ever gets this right. I mean, I think it makes the forms of action at common law look like a little simple child's exercise.
She argued that the board's decision in FOIA is inapplicable here because she, you know, regardless of the fact, as sister just noted, she's been sitting in the McHenry County jail. Because she has, you know, she's, fiction is that she isn't even in the United States. But is she right on that point?
Fueo, I think, is directly on point and controls the actions of immigration judges. Immigration judges' bench book cites to it, the immigration judges are bound by the decision of the board. The board has said, by its very nature, the relief sought can only confer advance permission. That means before you get here. That doesn't mean after you walk in and after you're caught doing something wrong, you can then step back and say, oh, well, I want a waiver for that. You have to disclose as part of consular scrutiny. And then, after you disclose, then you may seek a waiver of that disqualifying ground. The Fueo case, I struggled in my brief with this. What are we doing with this D3 issue? There was never an application for this. There was never a development of any factual record. There is nothing in this record to say that she ever established that she was eligible before the judge or the board. The board said that the judge gave every opportunity to apply for relief, and he did on three occasions and in writing. And to say that she was not on notice, that she had to apply for relief, is plainly incorrect.
I think it all depends, though, on whether D3 was at least potentially available to her. Your argument, of course, is that it wasn't, and there's no duty, at least I think it would be not sensible to impose a duty on IJs to give a long theoretical discussion of all the things they've rejected. So if it really wasn't at least theoretically, you know, or possibly available, then I don't see where there's a duty for the IJ to mention it. If it was potentially available, then it seems to me this isn't a purely adversarial system. The IJs do have a responsibility to consider potential avenues of relief.
There are two regulatory requirements for immigration judges. One is asylum. If an alien says that they fear persecution, the judge must notify and provide the forms. The other is, as mentioned by opposing counsel, in the application to adjust status. Satu Nice is an arriving alien and is ineligible as a non-immigrant to adjust her status.
Look, if she's correct about FOIAO, she's not technically been admitted. So she still may be eligible for a 212 D3 waiver. But in any event, that's a matter for the board to consider in the first instance. And the board rejected her effort to seek relief under 212 D3 solely on the basis of waiver. So how would it hurt to remand and let the board sort out any remaining questions?
The board is, I would rely on Fueo and the other cases cited. There has never been an application for this waiver in advance of entry. You cannot, an alien cannot nunc pro tunc, I'm back out of the country because I'm technically not in the country. The idea
well, she's
is
never been in the country.
She's not in the country.
She's never even she's never entered. Right?
She is not eligible for a D3 waiver, and it wouldn't cure the problem that she has with admissibility anyway, even if it went back to the board. Should I conclude? My time is up.
Only if you want to be let out of your torture. I mean,
to quote a baseball player, Your Honor, we do this every day. Thank you. The Attorney General would request that the court deny the petition for review.
Thank you, Mr. Mattson.
In response to a number of points made by counsel for the government, number one, all this discussion about what the consulate does and what the procedure is and what the it's not in the record. It's not in the BIA or IJ's opinion, and it was neither in counsel for the government's response brief nor his 28J submission. So I don't believe this court may consider those arguments. Second, even in Fueyo, the immigration judge considered the eligibility of Mr. Fueyo, of Fueyo for a 212D3 waiver. That didn't happen here. Both the IJ and the BIA in Fueyo made the determination that Fueyo was ineligible for such relief. Here, no such determination has been made. And on remand, if the BIA can articulate reasons why she's ineligible for 212D3 relief, that's a different matter. But they didn't do that. finally, as to specifically seeking 212D3 relief, the I-601 form, which is used to seek waivers under both 212I and 212D3, does not contain any space wherein the alien or her counsel may indicate the specific subsections under which relief is sought. So there was absolutely no notice to the petitioner here that she had to identify affirmatively each and every subsection under which this waiver was being sought. That's clearly based on the form, which is in the record and in the required short appendix. The form makes it clear that it is the responsibility of the agency to determine which sections, which subsections of the statute and regulation are applicable to the petitioner. In fact, there's a portion on the form where different subsections are listed, and the applicant is directed, do not write in this part of the form. So to suggest that every petitioner must name every precise subsection in order to preserve her claim from relief, that argument fails in light of the agency's own document instructing the alien how to apply. Does the court have further questions? Thank you very much. The petitioner requests that this court grant the petition for review and remand for further proceedings before the BIA.
You took this case pro bono, did
That's
you
correct.
Not? You have the enormous thanks work.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
You as well, truly, the thanks of the court.
Thank you very much.
Your appearance, the work that you have done on behalf. The case will be taken under advisement.